Welcome to the Swiss Institute, to the first panel this afternoon at 4 o'clock. I'm really proud of that show, of Rita Ackermann, who's here too, and actually she will be part of the panel next week, together with Charlene van Heel and Peter Doig. It's also at 4 o'clock. And I'm really excited to welcome Dan Graham, Harmony Corinne, and I want to thank especially Antoine Castella to moderate this afternoon's talk, and have fun.
Hi, thank you for being here. So I'm going to introduce Dan and Harmony briefly. On my left sits Dan Graham, considered by many a conceptual artist. Dan was born in 1942 in Illinois, but spent most of his childhood in New Jersey. Dan didn't go to college, and at the mere 20, he opened a gallery in New York City, a financial disaster, but the gallery saw the emergence of some of the greatest American artists of the second part of the last century, including Robert Smithson, Saul Lewitt, Carl Andre, Dan Slavin. After the collapse of the gallery, Dan relocated to New Jersey, and on his transit journeys, he conceived what would become one of his best-known pieces today, Home to America, a mock think piece whereby, through talking about the outskirts of the city, Dan reflects upon the desires and aspirations of the city center, a sort of a mirror effect. This self-aware self-definition in trompe-l'oeil is something that will be part of Dan's work all the way throughout. Dan is an avid music aficionado. He would go to music show with a huge tape recorder on his shoulders and tape all concerts, something that triggered a number of connections with musicians at the beginning of their careers, Glenn Branca, Steve Reich, Sonny Kuss, to name a few. Dan wrote about music in pretty sensational ways, and also directed two videos about music, Rock My Religion and Minor Threats, that are both pretty phenomenal. Always changing gear, Dan switched to architecture and urbanism and started to work on a series of fun and sometimes a bit unsettling outdoor pavilions made of two-way mirror. The two-way mirror, because of the semi-reflective quality, reflects the viewer onto the viewers, onto the cityscape, in a forever changing, morphing identity landscape. I don't have time to mention everything that Dan did, some pretty funny performances like Lax Relax, for instance, but I think I should mention Don't Trust Anybody Over 30, which is pretty much about a society of youth culture, a theme that permeates throughout Harmony Corinne's filmography, and especially in his latest film, Trash Humpers. Don't Trust Anybody Over 30 is a puppet play, and Dan can maybe talk about it later. Harmony Corinne sits to my right. Born in 1973 in California, he spent most of his childhood in Nashville, Tennessee. He moved to New York at around 18, and while skating, met Larry Clark, who asked him to write a scenario of what would become the movie Kids. The film made a huge splash, and Harmony went on to direct Gomo at a mere 23. I think Gomo is responsible for a huge fashion shift globally, and half of the people in Williamsburg, where I live, still look like they were part of the movie. As a Frenchie, I witnessed Gomo being responsible for introducing a Jerry Springer type of America to European crowds. This image of a white trash America resonated really well with the type of propaganda that runs throughout Europe. For instance, that America is composed of fat Jesus freaks who Europeans should be scared of. Around that time, Harmony moved out of New York to the suburbs, just like Dan, and later to France and England. Harmony also directed his movies Julian Donkey Boy, Mr. Lonely, and Trash Humpers, all films that gain instant cult status. In these films, oftentimes he places actors in situations and dares them to act, something I call skit directing. So Harmony merely sets an apparatus for things to unfold. A fan of vaudeville, Harmony's films are little sketches, collage. They don't follow an overarching narrative. Harmony is also very involved with music. The video for Will Oldman's song, No More Walk Horse Blues, being one of my favorite music videos of all time. In Trash Humpers alone, he features the musician Dave Cloud from the Gospel Power and Brian Kotzer from Lee from the Field of Youth. Trash Humpers is a very sad comedy about young people dressed in elderly costumes humping trash cans and street lights. Another thing about Harmony's movies is that they feature actors in costume and or play acting. Again, a sort of mirror-like perspective shift, a theme that runs throughout Dan's work. So both of you, you're kind of comedian a little bit, and I was wondering what were your like favorite comedy films?
I just wanted to correct something. I denied that I was a conceptual artist because conceptual art was pseudo-serious, like art after philosophy, and the people that influenced me most were artists dealing with anarchistic humor, Stanley Brown and Ankara. Son's work is very funny, existential point of view, and I think most of my work, including the pavilions, has something to do with play and humor. And to answer the question, before I was 13 years old, I used to love the films of Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin. Now they seem very silly. And then later I became very more involved with the work of Dean Martin than Jerry Lewis.
My favorite comedians? I always loved Marx Brothers. I like really base humor. I always pretty much liked physical comedy, slapstick, Three Stooges. Jerry Lewis is terrific, Buster Keaton, Kaplan. I like a lot of vaudeville stuff too, Eddie Cantor, Al Jolson, things that when I was pretty young, when I would take trips up to New York, my dad would take us before YouTube. We would go to like the Museum of Television and Broadcasting, and sometimes he would show me these things I think he liked, and I was pretty much amazed by some of the vaudeville performers, some of his performances and stuff. It was pretty exciting. So, yeah, comedy-wise.
Don't you like another film?
In terms of coming back to film, my favorite film is a combination of science fiction film and a satirical spoof. It's called The Tenth Victim by Ilya Petri.
Oh, yeah. It's a good one.
With Ursula Andrews, who's pretty amazing. She's Swiss, by the way, Ursula Andrews. And Marcello Mastroianni. My other favorite film was the film with Dean Martin and also a wonderful actress, Kim Novak, Kiss Me Stupid, by Billy Wilder. I really love all of Billy Wilder's films.
What was the one that they did together where they're riding on a camel in the sand together? Do you remember that one, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis?
Actually, you've researched Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. I can't remember anything because I was a very unobserving child at that moment. But the thing is that Dean Martin always plays himself. In other words, people think he's an Italian drunk, even though he was not a big drinker. So he just played that role. In other words, he dealt in sort of cliches. And Harmony and I have one of our favorite albums that we share, Self Portrait by Bob Dylan, where he croons all his old songs as if he's Dean Martin. He always said that his big hero was Dean Martin. Bob Dylan.
Yeah, that was the first time I ever met. I forget how it happened, but we were talking about that Bob Dylan record.
You gave it was Rita's birthday party, and you gave her a self-portrait.
Oh, that's what it was. He's got a really good memory.
Which, by the way, has a very terrible self-portrait of himself. They painted of himself.
Yeah, and he said the famous quote from that was that he had made that to get all the hippies off his front yard.
Yes.
And then you'd brought up the fact that, because he croons on a lot of it, and you'd brought up the fact that you thought it was him doing a Dean kind of imitation. Or a homage or something.
Yes, presentation.
Yeah, presentation. That's pretty, and we stuck with me. You saying that.
I'll tell you the kind of satiric music that I don't think I like. Frank Zappa, too moralistic. And I used to like Ween in the beginning, but I realized that they're misogynists. Ween.
Oh yeah.
And when I went to a Ween concert, there were all these NYU students. I guess we don't like NYU students. All these NYU students were kind of pushing down the women in the audience.
They were beating women.
Well, no, it was like a match play.
Not really.
Yeah, but the work was very misogynist, Ween.
Yeah. And that's the best part of it.
Oh yeah. But physical comedy does have some nastiness to it, right?
Yeah. I always loved it. I always thought there's like pain involved, right? So mm-hmm. Someone slips on a banana peel mm-hmm. and they crack their head. It's very funny. But it's also like someone getting hurt. I just thought that was always exciting. That's when I was trying to make these movies where I would get beaten up. In the film, I would start fights with people or provoke them. It's like about 12 years ago, provoke them to fighting me, beating me up. And it was a lot of it was kind of like, at least at the time, I was attempting to make what I would consider like a great American comedy, and which would just consist entirely of me getting beaten up. But a lot of it kind of, I was trying to distill what I had seen in like Stooges films and Keaton movies, but it didn't really work out so well.
You didn't get beat up?
Yeah, I did. I got beat up and got arrested and a lot of bones broken and stuff. But it just wasn't that funny. And then also people were always coming up to me on the street thinking that there was a camera following me all the time, and then they would just get punched out. I would just be getting smashed all the time. People would be smashing me. I just didn't have I wanted to make like a 90-minute feature that would just consist entirely of one fight after another. And I had forgotten how short the fights last. Two or three minutes, I wanted to fight every demographic. Noah's Ark or something. But I was like, I wanted to fight, you know, a Greek and a lesbian and just a kid, I would keep going. And I only made it like 7 or 8.
What do you think of Andy Kaufman's wrestling women?
Oh yeah, that's
which was
terrific.
That's pretty nasty. And then what he did apparently was he got every woman he wrestled, he got her address and phone number, and when he would appear,
he boned them.
Appear in different cities, he'd call them up and date them.
Yeah, that's the best part. He's dating. He likes big women.
Mm-hmm. I think my interest in comedy in my work comes a lot out of my Jewish heritage. And I think Jerry Springer is in that tradition of kind of low-key, ironic comments on things that are happening around him. When I did a performer audience mirror, describing the audience, it was almost like a radio announcer describing a baseball game, a play-by-play. Also, I think my work has a lot to do with self-consciousness. This piece I did, you might not be aware of, called Lax Relax, is an homage to Dean Martin. It's called Lax Relax. I did it in the 60s. In front of a tape recorder, the tape recorder is playing a woman breathing in and breathing out, saying the word lax. Breathing in and breathing out, in kind of like a yoga exercise, and I'm talking into the microphone, which comes out of the same amplifier. The word relax, breathing in and breathing out, relax. So everybody in the audience relaxes. It's like relaxes, gets more relaxed, and as I get more relaxed, I almost get into a state where I'm hypnotizing myself and the audience. I think it's still apropos now because of the interest in yoga. But the way I figured the piece out is I wrote an article about the Dean Martin TV program, And I think Dean Martin, I think relaxation is very positive in America, whereas the fact being lax means lassitude. And Dean Martin was too relaxed. In other words, he was like an Italian drunk. So there's a kind of puritanical ethos in relax, which is positive, and lax, which is negative.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Italian drunk.
Mm-hmm. Small town Italian drunk. He's from Columbus. I think he's from Columbus, Ohio. Ohio. Probably. Ohio. Oh, Sophie. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about you in comedy? Your films are kind of funny, but not really funny at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I think they're all funny. I think comedy is just strange. It's like what certain people find funny, other people find revolting. I've always thought it was kind of comedy is like confusing. So like what makes you laugh, it's like being turned on. It's like different for all people. So I always think of almost all the films as comedies. But a lot of times they're not watched that way or viewed that way. Just fine. I always set out to do like this, you know, to make a real silly laugh movies.
Well, I think films are comments on other films. Are you often begin as spoofs, right?
Yeah.
For example, the Tarantino film, Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah,
that's basically a spoof of a spoof. And some people I'm very close to thought it was an emotional film. I thought it was basically all that cliches of France during the war.
Oh yeah.
During World War II. And I think the French woman who's running the cinema, if it wasn't during the war, she would have had a torrid affair with a German soldier. Because Germans and Jewish people really love each other. There's a real connection. I think the fact that her boyfriend was black was also a cliche of that time period. And I guess most films deal in some ways with stereotypes and cliches.
Yeah.
Which are very funny by themselves.
Yeah, that's true. Uh-huh. I didn't see that movie, but...
I'm not a Tarantino film, but yeah. I thought that film actually worked.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Check that one out.
Do you remember the 10th victim?
Yeah. I should be watching it. It's been a long time. Mm-hmm. I was watching clips on YouTube, mm-hmm. trying to refresh my memory. But why don't you tell them what it is that you love about it? It's your favorite movie, right?
Mm-hmm. It's very 60s. It's based on a science fiction a story about the eradication of violence in the future. There's a contest which is followed worldwide, where one person is a killer and the other person the victim. So if the victim survives, they become the killer, and they go through ten different pursuers and victims. To become a national hero, and we're following Marcello Mastroianni, who's going to be the victim of Ursula Andrews, and even though they're supposed to kill each other, they wind up falling in love. Marcello Mastroianni makes his living with a sunset cult. So in Los Angeles, where the sun is setting, he puts drops in his eyes and cries and says, "Oh great sun, you are disappearing, or you are emerging." There's also a section where Italians really love their parents, but by edict they're supposed to kill their parents after a certain age. In Marcello Mastroianni's house, his parents are on a kind of a Marisol sculpture, where you push a button, they come out, and they act like old Italian parents. I don't know if you remember Marisol, but it's all very much about the whole likeness of the 60s. And the fact is, there's actually no violence in the film, even though it's about violence.
What is it about the movie that, like read it? Because you really love this film. So what is it that you think it is that resonates so deeply?
That it's a real, that it has a likeness to the 60s. The 60s wasn't really that. Was a period where the cliches of Los Angeles living resonate everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Hmm? Still, David Hockney picked up on that.
Yeah.
What about you in the 70s? Do you think Trash and Prose has something about the 70s?
No,
not
really. Like the 70s specifically?
No, movies in the 70s, because it's about...
Oh, movies.
Because...
Yeah.
Movies in the 70s, they were obsessed with the coming of television, and it's about the best of the medium.
Yeah.
And it seems that Trash Humpers has this quality because of the VHS. And to me, it's a personal theme. It's about the death of the moving image. I don't know if you ever think about these things.
No, I just don't really think about it that much, but I like... I guess what I was thinking about with that movie was that I wanted it to be more like a found object, more like something that was like a discarded. It was anything maybe it was more eight. I wasn't really thinking about a specific time, but I guess because I wanted it to be kind of like, I remember what it was like finding weird VHS tapes in the dumpsters behind the alleyways where I lived. This one lady next door. She had collected the entire year of 1987 CNN. On VHS, and I just always thought how strange that was, and how it would be nice to make a film that just kind of mimicked this idea of just a found tape, kind of like the kind of thing that my neighbor would throw away. But I wasn't thinking much past that.
The film is that's about the fear that filmmakers had of TV was The Apartment by Billy Wilder. I read a 600-page biography of Billy Wilder. He adapted to America very quickly. He liked football, baseball, everything on television, but he hated television itself. So in the film, the guy whose apartment is being used always had, the only thing he does at night is have a TV dinner. And I think a lot of Billy Wilder's films are about the fear of television. But of course, as an artist, I think we all learned a lot from Ernie Kovacs. And I learned a lot from conceptual television. I always like Candid Camera. Or Queen for a Day. I remember Roseanne had a very good TV program where she revived all these great conceptual television programs.
Did you like that show, Cops?
Actually, uncensored versions of Cops were given to me as a present by Patrick Kramer.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good show.
Yes.
It's still going, that show.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like the spin-off also. I don't watch too many things on Comedy Central, but I like Reno 9/11 and 9/20.
Have you seen that one, Campus PD?
Oh, no.
That's good, too. Mm-hmm. They just bust frat parties. One of the best.
What about you and TV? Did you do anything for TV?
Have I directed TV?
Mm-hmm.
I have never directed... like a sitcom. But I directed a couple of magic specials. And but I never directed anything where I was trying to think real quick that has ever made it on like regular television. I like TV. Something that's pretty exciting.
Why don't you describe I think we all love television now, in turn, as a physical medium, because it's dying.
Yeah.
What do you think of Nam June Paik's take on TV as furniture?
Oh, like sitting on it? Yeah, it's a good take.
Uh-huh.
What do you think about
Well, I'm referencing now to Antoine's wonderful installations, which also involve some influence of my work because they're involved with anamorphic distortions. But of course, the TV set itself was curved. It was anamorphically curved. I did this piece that was never realized the way I wanted it to be realized. But when I was at Nova Scotia College of Art in the early 70s, called Reception Production, it was when cable television was being introduced. They allowed public access programs to be made in different channels. So my this is a bit of a structuralist idea. I wanted to broadcast on one cable station through the control room. The image of the production of a local news broadcast during the time they call it the happy hour. It's because the local news broadcast is like a family of people who are making jokes about horrible things that were accidents and terrible things that were happening in the community. And one public access station showed the production, the other is a live image of people in their home, in their family home, looking at the news program.
Oh, wow.
And the third channel would be the actual news program.
Okay.
I'm a little critical of it because it's old-fashioned structuralism, but I really like the idea of the relationship of television to the family hour, or the happy hour.
Yeah, why didn't you make that?
Well, I tried to make it in what is another special college of art, but it turned out the public access wasn't allowed to use the one public access channel. And I think now of course everything is the public access situation is finished. There is no public access.
Yeah. Did you do
so it? I missed my slot.
Would it work on the computer? would it work to do that on the internet?
Well, the problem is I never go back and redo earlier pieces.
All right, once it's done, it's over.
Once it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
That's the way I am as well.
I was wondering if any of you had any questions, maybe.
I had a question for Harmony about Trash Humpers being in, like, being a feature film, because the structure of it, I mean, first when I saw it, I was like, that is not a movie, that's a video art piece. So I guess I just wanted you to talk a little bit about what it is, what it means to have something like that be a feature film in regular movie theaters.
Well, I just always want everything I do to be in the movie theaters. Like, because I just love watching movies, and I just always think that it should be in the movie theaters. But you can make an argument, a successful argument, that it's not even the movie, maybe isn't a movie. I don't even really care anymore. I don't even really know what a movie, like this idea of movies, like being 2 hours and it's a certain narrative and fitting into this idea. I just don't, it doesn't really mean anything to me anymore. So, so maybe it's not a film. Maybe it's like the first film to ever get distributed as a movie. That's not really a movie. But I always want it to be in the movie. I always want it to be on screen. Like whatever it is. And so, like, I always just thought that that's where it had to at least begin. But maybe it's not a film. I don't know. I mean, it's its own thing. I can't even say.
Well, the advantage of film is you have this great sound system, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's a big advantage.
It's also, I don't know, there's this idea that everybody looks in the same direction in TVs.
Yeah. Like, well, it's just that everything ends up on the couch anyway. Like, you just, it always, I mean, you're always, it's always going to end up there, but it just needs to start in the theater. Like, wherever it ends up, it doesn't really matter. You watch it on a TV screen, you watch it on your computer screen, it's fine, but for me, I always try to have it at least start in the theater. Or else, it almost doesn't exist for me.
I also want to know what you think of OmniMax or 3D.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't seen a lot of 3D stuff, but I'm not opposed to it. I think it's good. I think it's I don't really actually know all that much about the 3D movie.
Well,
it seems like everybody's making that.
Well, my objection to Omnimax is you put goggles on which reduce your peripheral vision. And I think the thing about seeing things in cinema is in a way you go into your own voyeuristic space, but you're always aware of the audience next to you. And so that's kind of peripheral vision voyeurism. In other words, they may be making out. And I remember when I saw the Runaway film at Landmark Sunshine, and I noticed there was a crowd of young female lesbians in the audience.
And my movie?
What?
At which movie?
The Runaways film.
The Runaways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they loved that movie.
What?
They were really into that movie. The lesbians in my neighborhood would line up down the block for that.
Mm-hmm.
But,
I was going to ask you for Dan. Could you talk a little bit about, you said that you wouldn't want to redo a piece, but like that piece where you're in the mirror and you're talking about the audience around you, like that would be really interesting for you to do that now. But why would you make the decision to not re-perform something or re?
Well, if it's in a remote situation, like I did this for an art school in Karlsruhe, because they really wanted to see it very badly. So I think if the area is very remote and they haven't had a chance to see it firsthand, I made an exception. But also I get very stale, because the whole thing about that piece is it's spontaneity, and I get less and less spontaneous about it. Although I did Lax Relax again for this wonderful show Overdone and Kike in Los Angeles, because the show is about the relationship between me and Lee Lozano, which was a very good concept for a show. They showed my income outflow piece and her cash piece, my detumescence piece and her masturbation piece. They also had Stephen Colton. Back, who was a friend of hers, doing a show, doing something on the other room. But that was historic. That was the period was the 60s, late 60s. So there was the Lax Relax comes from the late 60s. So I thought it was a good idea maybe just to reference that time period by redoing the piece. But in general, I'm no longer a performer. That was just a period in my life. But I was a performer because everybody in New York in alternative spaces was doing performance. I was able to do the performer and audience mirror actually in Riverside Studios in England, where there was a large mirror used in films and for dance that was actually in-house. I also wanted to do it in an alternative space in PS1 in New York, because it was a time when Joseph Beuys was doing performances. And I think my piece was kind of, he was a shaman, Joseph Beuys. And I was trying to do something that was more behavioristic, down to earth, and to deconstruct the idea of the artist as a politician. Also, the audience there was the art world. A lot of the work was about the community, so PS1 was a very good situation for that piece.
I'm curious, for both of you, what do you think the fun experience in the art world are, and also what you think, some things that you think are just really not fun, that everyone else thinks is fun.
You start.
Can you repeat that, because I have a little bit of a hearing problem.
What is funny in the art world, and what you think that is not funny that everybody thinks is funny?
Sarah Palin.
I guess I don't see enough shows promoting the art world to make a comment on that.
Yeah, I don't know that part either. I think most stand-up comedy is not too funny though,
mm-hmm.
anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They just tell jokes too quick.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'd say, it seems like too much of a routine.
Oh, I know it was very funny that I saw in the art world. I thought it was wonderful. The Roman Singer show here, that was hilarious, and also it was very physical.
Yeah.
And a lot of it. I thought that was a incredibly fantastic, funny. And of course, the Pentagon show at David Warner was very funny.
Yeah.
So I only know the I tried
Joe to Bradley to show's hilarious. What else is what's not funny? Like, if there are people, what is it? What's not funny that other people find funny?
Well, I think another place I haven't seen it. I didn't see this in New York, but I'd like to work with Wayne Weigman. I'm not so sure about all the things he's doing with Limeliners, but there's a highway restaurant complex near where my brother lives in Portland, Maine. And in the area above the counters, which would be like a Greek freeze situation, they're Limeliners as a Greek freeze. So I think a lot of it's the context.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I find his normal one-liner books a little formalistic.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's more like, just like, that's where I'm from, so I understand it, and like, it's like you don't even really think about it, it's like a part of you, it's like a place, it's like a, you know, it's part of like, my personality. I understand like the people, I don't know, it's just like, I just kind of understand it, I guess, I like that, and I like it, so it makes me sense.
Those black girls that you had in the fashion ad from Nashville?
Yeah, they were in a band that practices right by my house, and one of them was teaches a class at the School for the Blind, and some of them played basketball. They were all pretty much from right around my neighborhood. Yeah, they're pretty cool.
What about artists? I have two favorite comedic artists. One is the always popular Michael Smith.
Oh yeah.
And I also like John. I also like Christian Jankowski about 75% of the time. I think when he exploits dealers, it's embarrassing for the dealer and for me.
It's never good. It's never good. Yeah, no, I make. Yeah. I swear, I always think they're going to be like blockbusters. I mean, I'm not saying that. I like really always. Well, maybe not blockbusters, but I feel like they're going to be huge. And then, like, I'm always trying to make movies for a massive audience. It never works. It doesn't work out that way. But I'm always striving for that. I also make them for myself. I think it's possible to make things for yourself and other people, but I never ever want to put a limit on anything, and I'm always actually sad when not more people see it when it's not playing. And like, well, I want Gummo, for instance, to be huge, to play in all the malls across.
But he was kind of huge at the same time.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you know. Well, I don't know how huge it was, but yeah. Like, I want attraction for it to be taught in schools, or in the mandatory viewing in public schools.
But I read somewhere that you Trash Humpers was William Eggleston's, like, and his influence was his movies. In early films, video films.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't. I think someone asked me what the closest film to that Trash Humpers was, and I said,
yeah,
maybe it was Stranded in Camp Tom. That had a kind of liquid narrative. But it was never. With that movie, I honestly, when I was making it, there was no conscious reference to other to anything really other than it just being what it was, like a piece of trash. But I wasn't really thinking about it but so much in those terms.
But you're right in the sense that it does. There's a correlation between the two, even if you know, we're not thinking about it.
Yeah. I mean, he's a friend, and obviously I love this. Love what he does. He's from Tennessee. Yeah, I still think it is. Well, just people fornicating with trash, it's like great. And just, I feel like it's just something, like, in a lot of ways, what I find appealing about, like, the Stooges, it's the same thing. I was hoping that people would help, people would react to the Humpers. I just feel like they're really, you know, pure, and they have good hearts. And, you know, they just love just pumping and blowing things up. They're like, they try to just transcend regular evil and violence and make it something beautiful, you know. Like, make mischief, to elevate mischief into something really incredible.
I don't know what I really liked about it is when it involves other people. So it's kind of a shift in reality, but people kind of follow through.
Yeah.
And then you can see them in other ways, in a way. It's nice.
Beats the hell out of me. Like, I don't really know. I don't even think about it like that.
Well, are they comedians? Or are the movie, like, funny movie? Or is the actor?
Yeah. Well, what do you think? Yeah, so that's a good answer. Sounds good.
How would you feel about, you know, they like
redid
Frank Darling with Drew Barrymore?
How
would you feel if they did that with
SK or
something?
I mean, it's the money's right.
Yeah.
They can do whatever the fuck they want. They're gonna have those green backs.
Who would you have recasted?
What's that?
Who would you have recasted?
It's a Dakota Fanning. I don't know. Twilight cast. Well, when I make things, I mean, you talk about this too, maybe, but like when you make things, it's more, for me at least, it's more of like a feeling. So it's like, I don't usually have an agenda when I make films so much as, like, I'm not trying to, I never, like, start out with any kind of message, you know, or at least the message is difficult for me to articulate, so usually it's an emotion or it's a feeling, so, I mean, usually attracted to things that are I find like maybe slightly emotionally confusing, and some of the things that are funny and both maybe slightly tragic, things that work in on multi levels. And so usually, like when I'm shooting something and I feel like that's starting to happen, I won't question it too much. I just kind of go with it. I don't really. I try to, honestly, I try to tap into something that's more, that's difficult for me to articulate. It's more like a feeling. It's more like an emotion or something. Yeah, sounds good.
Do you push the actors when they're on set? Do you like force them to do like?
Chemicals or something. You put different things in a. You put these different chemicals in a bottle and you shake them up and you document it, the explosion. It's a process to push the actors.
Yeah, I like that.
What do you do with your actors?
One of my pieces, Past Futures, Put Attention. I wanted two people who knew each other, but not everything about each other. And the premise of the piece is a videotape. Was one person always talks about the future of the person who's describing their past. So the version that I use are two roommates from a slave as a slave art school in London, when one person is predicting a future that's not that not a very happy future for the other person, the person whose future is being predicted talks about something that's embarrassing in the past for the other actor. But I decided that I didn't want to be there to direct them, so I left the room and I just let them follow the premise of the piece. It's also about a kind of Möbius strip situation where one saying affects the other person in a kind of Möbius strip. In general, my work is more instructional than in terms of directing people.
Yeah, you don't improvise.
I don't improvise.
Yeah.
In other words, I improvise when I perform myself.
But you set up an apparatus.
I set up an apparatus, yes.
Anybody just like this shit? With my relationship with cartoons, it's funny, I was talking to a friend about that today. My wife yelled at me because she says it's not healthy to make your 2-year-old daughter watch 6 hours a day. So I gotta watch that. My relationship is usually I just have my daughter watch a lot of cartoons.
Which cartoons? SpongeBob?
Yeah, but those are pretty short. I like to put on the long ones. so I don't have to be interrupted. And I watch Handy Mandy. Little Bear.
What about you, Tim?
My use of car, actually, in video projection outside of house, that was just a still because it's a piece that I conceived in 78 where the video projector was being introduced and decided that instead of ornamentation, people should have a video projection outside of what they're watching on the home TV inside through the picture window. And when it was when it was finally realized in Santa Barbara, and I asked everybody, normally people would watch PBS, kids would watch cartoons, or maybe at night that people would watch porno. So it gives the idea of what family life is like to people on the outside as kind of ornamentation. But then I did this permanent video this installation called A World of the Sunset at the Haywood Gallery, where there are video monitors where kids can watch cartoons. But I also had cartoons, classic cartoons like Crazy Cat, historical cartoons which maybe grandparents can appreciate, and up-to-date cartoons like Powerpuff Girls. And the screen, the computer screens also show videos from British Arts Council, and one of the videos was Tracy Ullman's video Why I'm Not a Dancer, about her early sex life. So you could actually look at a cartoon if you're like 8 or 9 years old, and then press the computer screen and get Tracy Ullman's. So I'd like to mix cartoons with other content in this piece.
Yeah, that looks great. Mm-hmm. Oh, with the suburbs. I guess I just grew up. I never grew up in. I don't know if the suburbs. Like I never grew up in the suburbs, but I grew up in places. I guess that some people say looks maybe a little bit like the suburbs, but it's just real American stuff. It's everywhere.
Harvey?
Yeah.
As from somebody from Tennessee, have you ever gone to Dollywood?
Yeah. Actually, I can't really tell the story. It's pretty graphic. But I met this when I was like 13 or 14. I met this girl at Dollywood. It was amazing.
There was also a Twitty Land.
Oh yeah, Twitty, Conway Twitty. Twitty City.
Twitty City.
Yeah.
He actually lived there.
I actually had my bar mitzvah party there.
Really?
Yeah.
No, his family ran it, and he was in the top floor in the bedroom, and one of the children, who was a guide, said, if you yell, Conway, he might appear and wave to you, which he did.
Oh, yeah, he did, yeah.
So it became a kind of a family theme park where they actually lived there.
My rabbi, I had a rabbi who wore a rebel flag yarmulke. It's just to work there. Anyway, he would say the prayers. It was amazing. But Ruth at Tower, I don't know. Anyway,
so have you done anything with theme parks?
No, like specifically theme parks. No, yeah.
I actually think I think that what our artists are doing now is an antidote to Disneyland.
Is what?
An antidote to Disney culture.
Actually, explain that a little bit.
I think most cultural events are a little like Disneyland. And today there's a great interest in people doing work that's about spectacle. So I think the point is to do something that's anti-spectacle, but using the modus operandi of spectacles.
Is that what do you think? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's necessary because I think there's an entertainment industry.
So you think of art more in terms of entertainment than anything?
Well, I think the model for general cultural events, and it's certainly a good it's I'd like to work for big shows like Documenta, because in big shows like Documenta, Documenta is basically a combination of entertainment and education at the same time. And the shows are take place in the summer, and usually the parents come with their family in family cars, and they view they view these big art events as both entertainment and education. My critique of the Documenta that Catherine DeVee did was it was too much like Encyclopedia Britannica. It was full of lectures and everything was behind glass. So I think you have to relate to these very large thematic exhibitions that way. And then the next Documenta, which was done by Jan Hood, was more like Disneyland. It was all about entertainment.
Yes. We've been talking about that. That's embarrassing. You don't want to like.
Well, I think Harvey and I's work deals with something that's very popular, not very popular these days, Americana.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I have to admit that I've always been interested in Nashville products.
In what's that?
Nashville products.
Products. Products. Oh, yeah. You should come down and I'll introduce you to some product.
No, I like country western.
Yeah, me too.
Although it's very, my favorite country western star doesn't actually live in Nashville. He's Merle Haggard.
Oh yeah, he's in California.
Bakersfield.
Yeah.
But he's decided that he's against the oil industry.
Yeah.
His new friend is Willie Nelson, and he's become a lefty, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah. Merle's great.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have the last.
Call him the Hag.
Hag, yeah.
The last question is about today. I think it was discovered there's a 13th sign in the horoscope.
Oh, yeah, so explain that. So Dan is very much into astrology.
I don't understand it, but I'm very worried because I'm doing a column for Domus Magazine, the architecture magazine from Milano, about astrology and architecture. And I've just done the first one about Louis Kahn, who's an Aquarius, and I'm afraid it could throw off all my theories.
Do you have any other question to ask?
Why
I'm just trying to create magic. Thank you, though. Thanks.